Flowers in the Attic is not just a novel. It's a cultural phenomenon that has captivated readers for generations. This gothic tale of four beautiful children imprisoned in an attic by their own mother has sold over 40 million copies worldwide and been adapted multiple times for film and television. What makes this story so enduring? Perhaps it's the universal fear of abandonment, or the shocking taboos it explores, or simply the haunting question, what would you do to survive? Madonna once cited it as her favorite book, and its influence can be seen throughout pop culture, from references in American Horror Story to Taylor Swift's lyrics. V.C. Andrews created something truly unforgettable, a story that feels like a dark fairy tale but cuts deep into very real human psychology. The story opens with a biblical epigraph from Isaiah that sets the tone for everything to follow. Shall the clay say to him that fashioneth it, What makest thou? This question of powerlessness before one's creator becomes the central theme as we meet the Dahlenganger children, Christopher, Kathy, and the twins Corey and Carrie, whose idyllic life is shattered when their beloved father dies in a car accident. Their mother, Corinne, suddenly penniless with no marketable skills, reveals a shocking family secret. She comes from immense wealth, but was disinherited after marrying her half-uncle, the children's father. Now she plans to return to her childhood home, Foxworth Hall, to win back her dying father's favor and secure his fortune. The children are told they must hide in a single bedroom and adjoining attic until their grandfather forgives their mother, a process she assures them will take only a few days. What follows is a masterclass in psychological horror as the children are introduced to their grandmother, a tall, severe woman dressed entirely in gray with steel-blue hair and a face devoid of warmth. She lays down brutal rules. They must remain absolutely silent, perfectly clean, and hidden away because they are devil spawn from an unholy union. Most chillingly, she tells them, until the day your grandfather dies, you are here, but you don't really exist. The grandmother's religious fanaticism becomes immediately apparent as she obsesses over their potential for wickedness and sin. When Corey kicks her for grabbing his twin sister's hair, she delivers a stinging slap that reveals her capacity for cruelty. The children witness their mother's submission to this woman when she's forced to remove her blouse, revealing a back covered with welts. 33 lashes for each year of her life, plus 15 for each year she lived in sin. This opening sequence establishes the central dynamic that will shape the children's imprisonment. A mother willing to sacrifice her children's freedom for wealth, a grandmother who sees them as abominations, and four innocent children caught between forces they cannot control or fully understand. The attic becomes both prison and salvation for the Dahlenger children. While their bedroom is limited and confining, the vast attic above offers some semblance of space to play and grow. It's a gothic wonderland of discarded furniture, trunks filled with Victorian clothing, old photographs, and forgotten toys from generations past. The children discover a schoolroom where ancestors studied, with desks bearing carved names and dates from the 1800s. Kathy, our narrator, describes the profound silence of this space, so quiet you could hear your own heartbeat. The attic is stifling in summer, freezing in winter, and always dusty. Yet it becomes their only outside as months of imprisonment stretch into years. Christopher, ever the optimist, transforms this grim space into an adventure, fashioning swings from rope and trunk boards, climbing dangerously among the rafters to hang them. The children's creativity blossoms in captivity as they create a magnificent paper garden in the attic. Flowers of every variety crafted from colored tissue paper, crepe paper, and construction paper. They add glass beads and sequins to make their flowers sparkle, creating animals to populate their garden, and chalk daisies on the floor to form a fairy ring where evil is banished. This paper garden becomes symbolic of their situation, beautiful but artificial, a poor substitute for the real world they're missing. The attic also holds family secrets. They discover portraits of their ancestors, pale, sickly-looking people with sharp, cruel eyes. One particular portrait captivates them, a beautiful young woman with an enigmatic smile who Christopher notes resembles their mother. These discoveries help them piece together their family history, though the full truth remains elusive. As the seasons change outside the small attic windows, the children mark time by replacing their paper flowers with autumn leaves and winter snowflakes. Christopher, ever the optimist, paints watercolor scenes of snowy landscapes to create the illusion of windows to the outside world. Their one real plant, an amaryllis with a single bud, becomes their most cherished possession, a living calendar and reminder that life continues beyond their prison walls. The grandmother emerges as a towering figure of religious fanaticism whose destructive beliefs shape the children's imprisonment. She views the Dahlinger children not merely as unwanted houseguests, but as living embodiments of sin, devil's issue and devil's spawn, born from what she considers the ultimate transgression of incest. Every interaction with her grandchildren serves to reinforce her conviction that they are inherently wicked creatures who must be controlled through a brutal regime of fear, isolation, and increasingly severe punishment. Her elaborate system of rules reflects an obsessive preoccupation with modesty and physical purity. The children must perform even the most basic functions under strict guidelines, bathing without looking at their own bodies, using the bathroom separately, and maintaining full coverage of their flesh at all times. These rules extend beyond mere conservative values into a pathological fear of the human body itself. When she discovers Christopher inadvertently glimpsing Kathy's naked form, her reaction is swift and merciless, violently cutting off Kathy's prized hair and condemning all four children to a week without food, demonstrating how quickly she moves from religious authority to outright torture. The grandmother's calculated cruelty reaches its most vindictive expression in her nighttime assault on Kathy's hair. Sneaking into their room like a malevolent spirit, she pours tar into Kathy's golden hair while the girl sleeps, an act specifically designed to destroy what Kathy values most and what most closely connects her to her mother's beauty. This premeditated attack reveals the deep wells of resentment the grandmother harbors, particularly toward female beauty and sexuality, which she views as instruments of sin. Yet beneath her terrifying exterior lies a more complex figure, revealed through Christopher's nocturnal observations. He discovers vulnerable details about her: the wig that conceals patchy, sparse, yellow-white hair, her need for reading glasses while studying scripture, and most notably, her private moments of prayer seeking forgiveness, suggesting an inner turmoil between her severe religious convictions and her conscience regarding her treatment of innocent children. The grandmother's religious fanaticism reaches its most horrifying conclusion in her systematic poisoning of the children through arsenic-laced powdered sugar on their daily donuts. This methodical approach to murder, which ultimately claims young Corey's life, represents the ultimate perversion of religious duty. She transforms from guardian to executioner, convincing herself that eliminating these unholy abominations serves a higher purpose. Her actions reveal how religious extremism can twist natural familial bonds into weapons, allowing the perpetrator to justify the most heinous acts through the lens of distorted faith. The tragedy deepens as we witness how her own trauma and rigid beliefs have created a cycle of abuse, passing down damage through generations. Her interactions with the children become increasingly erratic, switching between moments of stern religious instruction and bursts of uncontrolled violence, suggesting that her own psychological struggles have become inextricably entangled with her religious fervor. The most devastating aspect of the children's imprisonment is their mother's gradual transformation from devoted parent to willing accomplice in their suffering. When they first arrive at Foxworth Hall, Corrine appears reluctant to subject her children to such conditions, promising their stay will be brief. She visits daily, bringing gifts and reassurances that soon they'll be free and wealthy. As time passes, her visits become less frequent, her excuses more elaborate, and her appearance more polished. She returns from shopping trips with expensive clothes and jewelry, while her children wear the same outgrown garments. The physical changes in Corrine, her glowing complexion, fashionable hairstyles, and manicured hands, stand in stark contrast to her children's deteriorating condition. The Christmas party scene provides a pivotal moment in understanding Corrine's transformation. When she secretly allows Chris and Kathy to watch the grand celebration from a hidden cabinet, they witness her dancing and flirting with a handsome man with a mustache, Bart Winslow, their grandfather's attorney. Rather than using this opportunity to plan their escape or reveal their existence, she's clearly enjoying her newfound wealth and freedom. Corrine's ultimate betrayal comes when she marries Bart without telling him about her children. She justifies this by claiming she can't risk revealing their existence until after her father dies and the will is read. Even more shocking is the discovery that their grandfather has been dead for nearly a year, and Corrine has inherited his millions while continuing to keep her children imprisoned. The final, unforgivable revelation suggests that Corrine herself may have been responsible for poisoning the donuts that killed Corey, as her father's will contained a codicil stating she would forfeit everything if proven to have children from either marriage. Her transformation from loving mother to someone capable of sacrificing her own children for wealth represents the story's most profound horror, the corruption of what should be the most sacred bond. The novel provides a haunting portrait of childhood development warped by captivity. When they first arrive, Christopher is 14, Kathy 12, and the twins just 5 years old. Over their 3 years of imprisonment, they undergo dramatic physical and psychological changes that reflect their unnatural circumstances. Christopher and Kathy experience puberty without guidance or proper context. Kathy discovers strange amber-colored hair growing where none had been before and develops breasts that both embarrass and fascinate her. Christopher experiences wet dreams and nocturnal emissions that he tries to explain away as something boys discuss in school restrooms. Their sexual awakening is particularly problematic given their isolation from peers and normal social development. The twins suffer the most severe developmental issues. After 3 years, they've grown only 2 inches, their once rosy complexions becoming waxy white, their blue eyes growing disproportionately large as they sink deeper into their skulls. When Kathy and Christopher attempt to take them onto the roof for fresh air, they panic in terror, having become institutionalized to their confinement. Their regression is evident in their speech patterns and superstitions, insisting on white sheets to keep away imaginary monsters and refusing pattern bedding that might allow small imps entry. Psychologically, the children develop coping mechanisms that reflect their imprisonment. Christopher becomes obsessively optimistic, always focusing on their eventual freedom and wealth. Kathy grows increasingly bitter and realistic, questioning their mother's promises. The twins retreat into their own world. Corey becoming nearly silent except when playing music. Carrie growing increasingly dependent on her brother. Television becomes their window to the outside world, teaching them vocabulary, social rules, and what society values. They absorb everything indiscriminately, particularly commercials that teach them cleanliness, appearance, and avoiding dandruff at all costs are life's priorities. This distorted education through media further warps their understanding of normal life. Most disturbing is how captivity alters their moral development. Isolation forces Christopher and Kathy into parental roles for the twins, creating an unnatural dynamic that contributes to their eventual sexual transgression. Their only adult models are their absent mother, who prioritizes wealth over their welfare, and their grandmother, who equates all physical affection with sin. Without proper guidance or boundaries, they develop a dangerously close bond that crosses into forbidden territory. Perhaps the most controversial aspect of the novel is the romantic and sexual relationship that develops between Christopher and Kathy. Their incestuous bond emerges not as an inherent desire, but as a direct consequence of their prolonged isolation and emotional dependence on each other. As they mature physically, they have no appropriate outlets for their developing sexuality. Their only model for romantic love is their parents' relationship, which was itself incestuous, as their father was their mother's half-uncle. The grandmother's obsessive focus on their potential for wickedness and unholy behavior ironically plants the very idea she fears. The progression toward their forbidden relationship is gradual and psychologically complex. It begins with innocent physical comfort, holding hands, sleeping beside each other during thunderstorms, hugging when afraid. As they mature, their awareness of each other changes. Christopher accidentally walks in on Kathy naked, transfixed by how she's developed. The grandmother catches them in this moment, immediately assuming the worst and punishing them severely. Their relationship crosses the final boundary after Christopher discovers Kathy has kissed their sleeping stepfather. His jealousy erupts in possessive rage. "You're mine, Kathy, mine!" Despite her initial resistance, they end up consummating their relationship in a moment of uncontrolled passion that leaves them both feeling doomed for eternity. The aftermath reveals their psychological conflict. They cry together on the roof, both feeling the weight of their transgression. Christopher promises it will never happen again, and they both recognize they've been victims of their circumstances. Rather than romanticizing their relationship, the novel presents it as a tragic consequence of their imprisonment, another way the adults in their lives have failed them by creating conditions that warped their normal development. This aspect of the story serves as the ultimate indictment of the adults who imprisoned them. By isolating these children during their formative years, they created psychological conditions that led to the very sin the grandmother was so obsessed with preventing. Throughout their imprisonment, the children's creativity becomes their primary means of psychological survival. They transform their bleak surroundings through imagination and artistic expression, creating beauty in the midst of horror. Kathy's ballet becomes her escape and identity. She practices religiously in the attic, using the bar Christopher constructs for her. Through dance, she can temporarily transcend her physical confinement, expressing emotions too complex for words. Her determination to become a professional ballerina gives her a future to imagine beyond their prison. Music emerges as Corey's special gift and comfort. When their mother brings musical instruments, Corey reveals a natural talent that suggests he's inherited the musical abilities of his deceased uncles. He creates his own compositions with heartbreaking lyrics that reveal his innocent longings. "I wish the night would end. I wish the day'd begin. I wish it would rain or snow, or the wind would blow, or the grass would grow." Their paper garden represents their most ambitious creative project, transforming the dusty, spiderweb-filled attic into a colorful paradise of their own making. This collaborative effort gives them purpose and allows them to experience seasons they can no longer witness directly. The paper flowers become symbolic of their situation, beautiful but artificial, created to survive in an environment where real flowers would wither and die. Reading provides another escape as they discover thousands of old books in the attic. Christopher devours medical texts that fuel his dream of becoming a doctor, while Kathy loses herself in romantic novels that shape her understanding of love. Through books, they continue their education and maintain connection to the wider world. Even their games reflect creative adaptation to their circumstances. They play Monopoly for hours, with the twins acting as bankers. They create elaborate stories in their fairy ring of chalk daisies, where evil is banished. These imaginative activities help preserve their childhood despite the unnatural conditions of their confinement. This creativity serves as both escape and preparation for eventual freedom, While their grandmother attempts to break their spirits through punishment and religious terror, their artistic expressions maintain their humanity and hope for a different future. The death of 5-year-old Corey marks the story's emotional nadir and catalyzes the surviving children's escape. After becoming violently ill, Corey is finally taken to a hospital, where he supposedly dies of pneumonia. His death devastates his twin sister Carrie, who retreats into silence, clutching his possessions and refusing to speak. The truth proves far more sinister. Through Christopher's nighttime exploration, they discover their grandmother has been systematically poisoning them with arsenic-laced powdered sugar on their daily donuts. They confirm this by feeding a piece to Corey's pet mouse, Mickey, who dies painfully within hours. This reveals that Corey didn't die of natural causes, but was deliberately murdered, likely with their mother's knowledge, if not her direct participation. This discovery, coupled with learning their grandfather has been dead for nearly a year and their mother has already inherited his fortune, provides the final impetus for escape. After more than 3 years of imprisonment, they realize no one is coming to save them, they must save themselves. Their escape occurs on November 10th after careful planning and preparation. They take only what's absolutely necessary, money they've stolen from their mother and stepfather, a few clothes, and Corey's musical instruments. As they leave their prison for the last time, Kathy reflects that the ghosts of their childhood will forever haunt that attic schoolroom. The cold November air feels like sparkling wine after their years of confinement. Carrie wobbles uncertainly on her feet, having spent most of her developmental years in captivity. When she asks if they're going to meet Corey, Kathy cannot extinguish that flicker of hope and tells her Corey is with their father in a beautiful garden waiting for them someday far in the future. As their train pulls away from Foxworth Hall, they glimpse their grandmother's shadowy figure at the window, searching for them, a final image of the woman who tried to destroy them but ultimately failed. They head toward Sarasota, Florida, where flowers bloom year-round, an appropriate destination for children who survived as paper flowers in an attic, now seeking to bloom in real sunshine at last. The epilogue reveals that while the children escaped their physical prison, the deep psychological scars of their captivity persisted throughout their lives. Chris and Kathy demonstrated remarkable resilience as survivors, though their relationship remained tempestuous, marked by intense emotional swings and complicated by their shared trauma. For Carrie, the path to recovery proved especially challenging. The loss of her twin Corey created a void that seemed impossible to fill, and she required constant encouragement to embrace life, even when surrounded by the beauty of roses that once gave her such joy. The narrative framework, told through an older Kathy's voice in both prologue and epilogue, reveals someone still grappling with trauma decades after the events. She writes with bitter tears and shame, wielding her truth like a weapon through her published account. The raw emotion in her words, the mix of anger, grief, and determination, suggests that time has not fully healed these wounds. Though she claims to have simmered down enough to write with clarity, her decision to hide behind fiction while hoping to inflict pain on those who wronged her reveals the complex layers of her healing process. This framing device powerfully illustrates the far-reaching impact of childhood trauma. The children's experiences in the attic fundamentally altered their understanding of family bonds, trust, and self-worth. Their perception of maternal love was permanently distorted by their mother's betrayal, while their grandmother's cruelty taught them that authority figures could be sources of terror rather than protection. These early experiences created patterns that echoed through their adult relationships, career choices, and parenting styles. Yet despite this heavy legacy of trauma, the story stands as a testament to human resilience. These children endured systematic abuse, emotional manipulation, physical neglect, poisoning, and the devastating loss of their youngest member. They maintained their capacity for love and human connection despite conditions deliberately designed to break their spirits. Their escape represents not just physical liberation, but a profound psychological victory, an assertion of their fundamental right to exist, grow, and flourish in the world. The novel's lasting impact derives from this powerful tension between darkness and light, between the depths of human cruelty and the heights of human resilience. Like the paper flowers they meticulously crafted in their attic prison, these children began as bright, vibrant beings who gradually faded under the weight of their captivity. However, unlike those delicate paper creations, they found the strength to break free and seek real sunshine. Their story carries the profound message that even after experiencing the most twisted and traumatic childhood, the possibility of renewal and healing remains, though the path may be long and the scars permanent.